20-minute episode of Double or Nothing. Michael Frazes, how are you going?
Good, Misha. How are you doing?
I'm very well. I feel like since we last spoke, you know, it's been about a week and a half or 2 weeks, like decades have happened. You know, Credit Suisse, you know, a 165-year or whatever institution is no longer here, kind of merged with UBS. You know, it feels like either there's a banking crisis or the rumblings of one. And yet somehow, to be honest, everything's kind of, it feels quite calm. It's unclear whether things are going to get really turbulent or whether it's not obvious to me what, you know, how things are going to play out. What do you reckon?
I think it's tough. I think we're definitely in a new regime now. We've got interest rate pauses around the world. The Fed did one hike, which I think will probably end up being a mistake. But you're right, it's kind of a holding pattern. But imagine this is kind of what it felt like in 2008, where everybody knew there were these huge problems, but things hadn't really gotten that bad. And I guess, you know, we talk about the banking crisis. It's still a real thing, right? There's still no reason to hold your money in a mid-tier bank or regional bank. You know, you can get much higher yield for less risk in U.S. Treasury accounts, which is like a direct consequence of, you know, this radical Fed policy.
So it's just an American thing. I mean, America has, 8,000 banks or something. You know, we've got like maybe a couple dozen, really four, like really. Is that going to affect us? I mean, I've been speaking to a few big banks in the U.S., just they're kind of come and chat to us occasionally. One could not manufacture a situation that would give them more power. You know, they're inundated with deposits now from, you know, as they flow from regional banks. They don't even want them, to be honest, but, you know, they're able to kind of pluck out one. And, you know, we spoke to one bank that kind of bought the UK business of SVB. A US bank is just basically, you know, can be very selective around what it buys and what it does. And so it feels like, those big US banks are just getting bigger and more powerful. And talking to some credit lawyers yesterday, and they're saying that the local banks even are pulling back a little bit in terms of lending. So, you know, I wonder if that's going to start hitting here a little bit. On the flip side, you know, I was talking to some data room providers, and they think there's massive pent up demand for transactions. You know, the last 6-12 months have been a bit turbulent, and there are a whole bunch of folks trying to sell assets this year. So I think it's a bit unclear. We've kind of got this pent up, boom coming in terms of transactions. You know, Virgin IPO will probably get away at some value this year, might open the floodgates to reopen IPO markets. But kind of looming in the background is this, you know, are we in the middle of a banking crisis, and what's going on?
Yeah, I guess it's kind of like the second or third order effects that are the hardest to discern. Like with deposits fleeing from these banks in the US, which by some measures do 70% of certain aspects of lending in the United States, do they then, how does that pull them? Like, they're obviously going to have to pull back because capital is draining out. And it doesn't matter that they've borrowed from the Fed to pay deposits, that's still capital they don't have. What's the effect of that? And I think you're right. It's hard to see. It doesn't seem to have hit as hard in Australia. I think because the yield curve isn't that inverted here, and there's no kind of worries about the stability of banks. And I think the Australian regulators are pretty clear that depositors will be protected, you know. But funnily enough, I think interest rates didn't get as extreme here. So it wasn't like 5% in short-term treasuries versus 0% banking in your bank. And it's not just the regional banks, it's the big banks getting outflows as well, like inflows from the regional banks, but net deposits leaving the system. So who knows, like, how does that affect lending? I'm not sure. I mean, you're right, in terms of capital markets being shut for a long time now. So that means profitable companies are building up profits, buying back shares, but there's been no kind of corresponding like issuance of shares. In the same way, the kind of like mass issuance of stock with the SPAC boom and everything kind of heralded the top. At some point, there's going to be you know, those factors will flip into reverse. And it could even be triggered by you and your friends in private equity who are coming into all the different small caps. You know, so you buy out, you know, IntelliHR or whatever these, or there's, you know, there's probably more than 10 now. That cash goes back into the stock market, into fund managers. Invariably, you then buy other small cap stocks with the proceeds. So that could be the kind of thing that puts a floor under it.
We are seeing it. Like, I think, you know, we've talked about it a little bit over the last 6 months about how, you know, funky capital structures are kind of burning holes in companies' pockets, and increasingly, you know, like, there are very few buyers today. And so you're kind of seeing, you know, PE being selective around which public companies they're going after. You know, valuations are kind of within private equity zone of kind of attraction, and there aren't that many alternatives. You know, it's very hard to get you don't really want to do a heavily discounted rights issue when you can sell for a premium to private equity. So I think you're right, and we'll continue to see private equity being seen as a more attractive form of capital.
But you know, it has played out. Coming back from San Fran, I was thinking, like, the best play here is big tech, just on cost cuts, and, you know, they'll be fine, and buying back shares and all that kind of thing. Well, the small cap companies will be on the receiving end, and that's played out to a T, like, the last few weeks. You know, big cap tech has just absolutely ripped and left everything other than semis in the dust. You know, a lot of software companies are down this month. A lot of companies are down. I think the advanced decline is one of the worst it's ever been. So, like, that breadth indicator where it's like a handful of companies leading the market, which happened in 2021 as well. So at the top of the market there, it was really just a handful of companies driving it. And then that whole year, one by one, like, other companies were falling away. It was kind of frustrating. People asked, we were in that kind of space. So we could see all the carnage under the surface, but there's a handful of names propping things up. And that has again reached a massive extreme now. But there's very good reasons for that. I mean, those companies are dramatically cutting costs. And so they're going to get, you know, huge, massive increase in margin over the next year or two. While at the same time, this cycle is like hitting those small cap companies so hard because, you know, every time someone's fired, that's all those licenses go. It's a pretty tough environment for that end of town. So that's kind of played out. But
I've got a question for you. ChatGPT, yeah, has just announced it's got all these kind of plugins that it's going to be sourcing a bunch of information from, and, you know, you can kind of plug it into Wolfram, which is like a, you know, like a math support platform, or, you know, through Expedia or whatever, and direct it accordingly. And basically gives you, you know, really enhanced, improved answers as a result. And it's going to have, like, you know, a gazillion different plugins. And so basically you can direct it to source from wherever you want it to. Is that going to enhance those underlying company values, or is that going to kind of maybe disintermediate the wrong one because you're plugging into those companies, but is that going to reduce the value of those underlying companies, or is it just another channel to market?
I think the shift is so big that it's really clear that it's like an opportunity and a threat to everybody. Like, it's just a complete upending of everything. You know, it means that, like, incumbents will have to probably fight for market share again. You know, we talk about, like, GitLab and DevTools. You might have seen Replit, which is like this relatively new company that's come out. It's really easy to code in the browser. So they were really fast to get, like, a ghostwriter, like something that does coding for you, and then being really forward on the AI tools. And they've just kind of massively taken off. Meanwhile, you've got, like, GitLab, which hasn't really bothered to do any of that as of yet, which is languishing. And now all of a sudden, Google just announced a big investment in Replit. So they've been buying up shares in GitLab, but now it seems like they're trying to back a horse in the other one. And I think that's just going to happen across the board. Like, the people that embrace it and take the advantage of it by, like, putting plugins on OpenAI and, like, really kind of, like, adapting to it, even at risk of cannibalizing existing products, by far, it's just the only strategic thing you can really do. But the vast majority of companies, like, this is, it's hard because I know we spend a lot of time on Twitter, so we're really up to date on a lot of this stuff. But the vast majority of people, it's just something they've heard, you know, it's not something they've tried. Most people haven't used any of the tools. They certainly haven't come into almost any other than tech company workflows. You know, you're still, like, right at the beginning of this shift, and it's,
But yeah, I'm worried. Like, as in, I'm an investor in Zapier, for example, and I can't tell whether it's really good for Zapier because basically you can plug it in and you just enhance those existing integrations, and so it effectively, you know, GPT effectively acts here as, you know, a tool for incumbents and kind of, you know, enhancing existing shares and capabilities, or whether Zapier ultimately gets disintermediated. And I'm kind of leaning towards the former, but as you say, it's early days. It's, you know, it's hard to know. It can kind of cut both ways.
Yeah, I mean, it's in some ways it can be easier to pick kind of losers. Actually, there's probably clear winners and losers. Like, the losers would be, for example, a no-code platform. So people are now, without any coding experience, can like go on, use these AI tools and just code up an iPhone app and launch it on the App Store like that day, which is just not something that was feasible for anyone to do. Like, it's going through books, websites like Stack Overflow, which is just useless, Googling things, trying to get answers. It's just a huge effort. But now that can be done in a very short period of time. But there was like a whole boom in like kind of low-code and no-code tools, of which kind of Zapier was kind of part of that movement. But that don't really make sense anymore if you can just ask it to code something up and eventually speak to it computer directly and get them to code the app up and then ask them to like change the font or like adjust it or like have this the drop down menu that does that. You know, they're already like Replit is actually launched, has already got a product that does that. So that's like a whole swathe of like businesses that are like probably going to come under a lot of pressure. What else? I still think semis are probably the number one way to play. I mean, this is, if you've tried to check GPT-4, you'll notice it takes a long time. Like, it has to think a lot. You know, there's obviously a huge amount of computing going on in the background if it's taking that long to think. And, you know, you've got NVIDIA, which is obviously number one. We've also got AMD, which is half the price. And companies like Microsoft have a strategy of going for commodity suppliers. So Microsoft's more than capable of creating their own chips, but they won't do that. They'll prefer to foster like a supply chain and make it a commodity product that other people have to deliver. But they don't want to have NVIDIA doing, you know, with 100% market share. So I think AMD's got about 20% now, but they'll foster that and they'll make sure there's that number two. It's pretty interesting opportunities there. But again, big tech probably wins because the compute goes up. It's probably good for most of their platforms, you would think.
Yeah. What else is happening in the Australian market that you're seeing?
What's been happening in Australia? I feel like there's a lot of excitement over lithium at the moment. For whatever reason. I mean, that was.
To be an investor in Liontown, the big lithium that just got big takeover off. I probably
Yeah, I didn't know. It's one of the first. Do you know about?
I don't know that much about it. I kind of invested when it was a bit of a punter lithium stock. So I made up pretty good, but I probably sold about 30 or 40% ago. So about a year ago. So I probably left a fair bit on the table, unfortunately. But you know, you can't perfectly time these things, and it was a bit of a punt at the time. So it's hard to feel bad about those. But so no, I don't actually know that much about it. It was just a lithium punt early on.
Yeah, hard to tell. I mean, like, I feel like there's, in the Australian market, you've also got small caps who've been decimated but are selectively being bought up by private equity, which is annoying to anybody that wrote them down, because it's like, well, private equity is going to pay 3 to 4 times the market price and probably make another 3-4 times on top of that. So a public investor could well have been right that they'll deeply, deeply, deeply undervalued, but just has to take the loss. I sort of read Bubble, which was something like we owned that years ago. It must have been like 2020, which feels like a very long time ago. It's like it's got like a 30 mil EV now. You know, it's got 90 mil of cash and 120 mil market cap. Obviously problems, and they now need to massively cut costs. They've got like over 400 mil of revenue, which does give them some leeway. Like, there is room there to cut costs. There's a ton of things like that that have just down.
So that's an interesting one. I'm not close to it. I don't know how deeply you know it, but I noticed that as well. And I guess, like, without actually looking at it very much, I guess the question there is, where does it go, and where does its growth kind of come from? And so you can cut costs, obviously, and kind of hopefully buy time. And even if you kind of get to break even, you've got you've got optionality. But, like, you know, as an Australian marketplace of those kinds of products, you know, presumably they need to kind of go international or elsewhere. Like, where does that growth come from? And then you're kind of competing against real big dogs, you know, the Etsy's and the like of the world.
Yeah.
Is that right framing? That's like a cursory low information take.
I think they're almost got to go the other way and just cut costs until they get to, they can actually make profits and stand up value on like a $10 or $20 million profit. Like I think their best year was like a $40 or $50 million after tax.
Hmm.
Maybe it was EBITDA. Like they did make a lot of money at one, okay. But then like everything else, everything just collapsed, and now they're losing $20-25 million a year. Can they cut? They'll have to cut costs 5% to get to break even. But then in this market, they need to go further and like actually generate a profit, and then people will be interested in them. And I feel like it's almost similar to the stuff we're seeing in private land. It's like you just have to cut because the VC investors, it seems like VC, everybody still wants to find new exciting ideas, but the kind of busted companies, or not busted, but the troubled companies from 2-3 years ago that raised a lot of money on these difficult cap structures and now probably have had a year of flat growth or maybe even negative, that's where like the real crunch is. And then companies in those situations, they almost need to like just cut and just keep cutting until they find either profitability or not.
You know, we've been chatting to a bunch of VCs and VC-backed companies. You know, we've done, you know, over a dozen investments, and, you know, we haven't bought once from a VC. Like, there's still such a big valuation, you know, bid-ask spread. And even, you know, we're never going to invest in the top few kind of performing assets in a VC portfolio, but there's this... As you just said, there's this kind of tail of, you know, moderate performers that are not performers from a VC perspective, but are fine businesses with fine founders looking for a home. Mm. And I think they're a bit lost at the moment. You know, they're not being supported by their VCs. They don't know what to do. They're not really being bought out yet. And, you know, like... It's unclear what actually happens over the next 12, 24 months with them. Obviously, I'd say that their natural home is probably with a private equity owner, but they don't seem to agree often. So, it'll be really interesting to see what happens. I mean, it'll be really interesting to see what happens with the VC portfolio overall. Like, there are a lot of very poor performing VCs in this country, and we won't know that for a very long time. And even in a lot of the really good VCs, you know, there are a lot of poor performers within the portfolio, which is kind of normal and what you'd expect. You know, we haven't really seen some of those superstars take off that they need. And so there's but you know, who knows? Maybe this is just a sentiment thing. You know, obviously right now we're probably in the trough of kind of sentiment and maybe that's just a reflection of that. And maybe, you know, a lot of those will be, you know, really popping over the next, you know, few years.
You know, what does matter a lot to the entire system is Canva, because everybody's in it. Everybody uses, that's what marked everybody's books up. That's what raised all the money. A lot of funds kind of transferred, shares from one fund to another to kind of realize profit. It was all kind of like an Australian VC, bidding up every value, right? Without eventually getting the exit. And then where does Canva sit now in an AI world? Like, everything's up for grabs now in their land as well. I'm sure they're very smart and they've got a lot of like kind of tools and obviously huge traction. But you know, there's a lot of very good software companies trading for 2-3 times sales. Which even if they're at $2 billion revenue or whatever it might be, you know, that's kind of 4, 6, 8 billion valuation, not 50. And, you know, the absolute most expensive software companies are now kind of 10 times forward sales or less. So even that's a pretty big markdown. But, you know, it's all up for grabs in that kind of design space. Like, who knows how this AI stuff plays out. And whether Canva's the best, Adobe had a great product. Maybe it's something new. Maybe it's some other product. I do know that stuff. There's kind of been like a missing gap in that generative like image stuff, where it's been really hard to use text and really hard to get something specific. Like, very good to get a mock-up of a site, but so far hasn't gone that next step and actually put the text in the right spot. Apparently the next generation, like Midjourney, is going to be able to do that. So you can actually just mock up not just the design with these like fake letters or fake words, but actual like what you want to say at various points. And if that happens, then that's going to really change design, because I'm not sure why you wouldn't just use that and just ask it to create whatever it is that you want to do, get you 4 options. Okay, I want another 4 different types. Okay, I like these 3. Give me 5 variations on each of these 3. I want you to change this, and then boom, you're done.
And then it's a perfect example of what we were discussing before. You know, does AI kind of support incumbency, and does Canva rush to integrate it, which it already has to some extent, or does it get disintermediated entirely in the way you just described, which, you know, seems intuitive and compelling, but frankly, it could kind of go either way. Oh, like, what is Canva's real moat at that time, where you could just go straight to Midjourney and ask it to do whatever you want?
Better than you could using Canva design tools. So that'll have a huge impact on the outcome of that. Will have a huge impact on the VC landscape here, I think. Not just because it'll mint so many wealthy people, but also like kind of it's probably the most important thing to all those funds' returns. Anyway, I think you need to run off.
I've got to run, Mike. I appreciate you making time early. And I know it's early for you. That was quick and sharp and fun. And we'll chat soon.
Sounds good. Good to have a chat, Misha. Speak soon.
Bye.